Welcome everyone to Daf Yomi Shkalim, 1 week at a time. This is our second shiur in Masechet Shkalim, and interestingly enough, we will be finishing next week. So those of you who Bezrat Hashem are enjoying it, great. If it's a little bit more challenging, so it will be ending next week. We'll talk more about that at the end. Today we are going to be reviewing Daf 10 through 16, Yud through Tetzain, which is this week's Daf. And we have a lot of ground to cover. This week, there are some really incredible stories, which I am really looking forward to sharing with all of you. So welcome, everyone. I hope everyone had a lovely Pesach. And let's begin. So we're actually going to start at the Mishnah at the bottom of Daf 9, Daf Tet. We didn't do it last week because I just wanted to bring it in today. So at the bottom of 9, we have the Mishnah that talks about what we did with the money that was collected. Last week, we really discussed in detail how the machatzit ha-shekel, how the shekel was collected, when, who, what all the details were about collecting the money. And now the question is, where did the money, what was the money used for? So that's what we're going to discuss today. So the way the Gemara describes it, or the Mishnah calls it the Trumat Halishka, meaning all the money that was collected was put into these collection boxes, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. And what were they used for? So the Mishnah at the bottom of 9 says that they were used for the Korban Tamid, the daily sacrifice that was, that was done twice a day, where we have Shacharit and Mincha. Nowadays, our prayer is parallel to those sacrifices. So the Korban Tamid, the money that was collected by the Machatzit HaShekel, was used to buy these animals. And basically, any communal sacrifice was paid for by the Machatzit HaShekel. Again, it's a beautiful idea that every person, right, think about it, every person gives in a half a dollar or $5, and that's your buy-in for every communal sacrifice, right? So every time a communal sacrifice is brought in the temple, it's with everybody in mind, figuratively, but also literally, right? That was the money that was used. So the Mishnah at the bottom of 9 says it's for the Korban Tamid, which is daily, the Korban Musaf, which is monthly plus any holiday. It's for all the Nesachim, meaning the wine and the oil and the flour that were brought with all of these communal sacrifices. It was for the Korban Omer, which is very appropriate as now we're in the time where we count, right? Sfirat HaOmer, the counting of the Omer. For those of you who are not familiar, it is the counting every day between Pesach and Shavuot. We are counting 49 days till we receive the Torah on Shavuot. But why is it called Sfirat HaOmer? Omer is the barley sacrifice. It was a sacrifice that was brought every day in the temple for 49 days. So that was also from the funds of the shekel that was collected. The same thing, the sacrifice on Shavuot, the Shtei HaLechem, the two loaves, the Lechem HaPanim, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, the showbread. So basically, any communal sacrifice or expenditure in the temple, they used the shekel. Again, here it's called the Trumat Halishka. We're now on Daf 10 at the top, and there's a question if a person can volunteer to give more or differently, and the Gemara discusses an interesting idea that there were certain families that donated wood to the temple, And it was actually a family holiday. There were 9 of these days throughout the year, and there were 9 families that it was their tradition that on that day every year, they would donate wood to the temple. And we see here, this actually happened when when it was called Shivat Zion, when they returned from the Babylonian exile. And these families took it upon themselves to volunteer to donate wood. And the Gemara explains that, look, this is private wood that's donated into communal funds. So we see here that people can donate things and, let's say, donate time. Then people say, oh, no, you can't learn from here because everybody agrees that you can donate wood, but maybe not other things. And we see here that there's a machlok, if there's a difference of opinion, if it was okay to donate or not. Wait, Lynn, did I say only barley on the altar? Correct. Meaning, yes, Lynn, the Omer Korban was daily for 49 days. Meaning all other korbanot were regular, but the korban haomer was for 49 days. It was given every day, in my understanding. Okay, and then since we're talking about the Omer again on Daf 10, the Gemara describes that the Omer has to be from Israel, the barley that they are, just interesting agricultural fact, that right now is the barley harvest, exactly after Pesach, and in about a month, right now the wheat is growing, but it's not ready, which is why, interestingly, and it's beautiful, right, the story of Ruth that we read on Shavuot, what is she doing? She's gathering the wheat, right? The wheat harvest is around Shavuot, which is when we bring the korban called Shtei HaLechem, which is actually bread made out of wheat. Till then, we're bringing barley. So it's just an interesting fact. So the Gemara says on Daf 10 that the Omer has to be grown in Israel. You cannot import it. It could not be from Syria either. Rather, it has to grow in Israel. So to all the korbanot, they need to be grown in Israel. And the Gemara talks about there are 10 levels of holiness, in the world, and Israel is the holiest of all, and that's why things that grow need to have been grown in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, to be put on the altar. And then there's a discussion about Shemitah over there, which we'll talk about another time. Okay, back to our shekel money that was collected. It says that, what about the payment of the watchman? And it says that the money from the money changers, remember that they got money, they got like a fee, that could go to the watchman. And then, again, we have the shekel, remember, that we collected. That then becomes kind of a transfer. The sanctity is bought. You buy the Omer with that money, and then it's given to the money changers, and that's how they paid the money changers. Meaning, again, because the money had a certain sanctity, you couldn't give it to them right away. Rather, there was kind of a transfer of the sanctity through different things, and we'll see that in a minute again, in a minute. The same thing with the stone cutters. It describes the same idea that, again, these are people who needed to be paid with temple funds, but you had to be careful because we don't want to misappropriate temple funds, and therefore we have to redeem those funds on something sanctified, and then you can use it to pay the workers in the temple. We're now at the Mishnah at the bottom of 10, and it says, what else did we use the money from the Trumat HaLishka, from the Shekel? So it says that the Para Aduma, And the red heifer, that was the cow that was burnt, and the ashes were used to purify people who were impure with tumat met, with impurity from a dead body. So that was something that was very important. And they also bought the goats, the seir hamishtaleach, the goats that was sent out on Yom Kippur. And the red thread that was also involved with the ceremony with the red heifer, that was bought with the money from the shekel. And the leftover money from the shekel, which we mentioned last time, it's called shiarei truma talishka, meaning after they remove money to buy the sacrifices, whatever is left over now has, I guess, like a lower sanctity, and it's now used for other things. The Gemara talks about that money was used to build the ramp that went from the Beit HaMikdash to the Mount of Olives. You can see here there's a picture of it. There is this idea that there was a ramp. We're going to talk about it in a little bit. A ramp that was built, interestingly, maybe every year, maybe every few years, though I'm part of a Facebook Dafyomi group, and there are archaeologists who kind of dismissed the idea that there was such an intricate, large bridge, because they say that they haven't found any archaeological evidence about it. But there is some sort of ramp, and we see here from the Mishnah and then the Gemara that there is a ramp that is constructed from the Temple Mount. Again, you can't really see it in this picture, but there's a very deep valley, and then up to the Mount of Olives. This ramp was used for two things. One was for the red heifer, which was actually burnt on the Mount of Olives. So they had to lead the para aduma out. The other is for the goat, as I mentioned, the seir hamishtaleach, the goat that was sent out on Yom Kippur. It was sent to the desert via this ramp. So they used the leftover money for this ramp, also for the wool that was tied between its horns, for the waterways in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, and the walls of Jerusalem, and any city needs, that was used from the leftover money. Then the leftover from that, they would use to buy wine or oil or flour the leftover wine, oil, and flour was then sold to the people again with sanctity, or maybe no. We're going to talk about can the temple actually create some sort of business deal, right? If they have left over wine or oil, can they sell it to somebody else who needs it and make money for the temple? There's actually a machloket whether or not they're allowed to kind of turn a profit. Interesting. Yes, that's true. Lynn says that maybe it was destroyed by enemies. Archaeologists might say even if it was destroyed, there would be some remnant. But you're right. I don't think that is a reason to dismiss it. Just because they haven't found it doesn't mean it's not there or it didn't exist. So I agree 100%. The Gemara discusses again the three red strips of wool that were used in the temple. One was used, as I mentioned, for the goat that was sent out to the wilderness. One was used for the ceremony with the mitzorah, with someone who had leprosy, and the other is for the para aduma, again, as I mentioned, the red heifer, and they had different weights. From here, the Gemara discusses who you can pay. Again, we mentioned communal needs, right? How do you, right, think about this? I think it's just interesting to think about if you set up a charity for communal needs, how do you define communal needs, right? How do you define temple needs, right? I understand sacrifices. I understand the workers. Can I extend that to other people? So the Gemara mentions, what about the scholars that come to teach the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, so he can be paid from that money? What about the people who examine blemishes of the animal sacrifices? They can be paid from this money. How about this person who comes to fix the Torah scroll that is kept in the temple, right? Again, can they be paid from this money? How about the women who wove the all the curtains in the temple, right? So they need to be paid. They can also pay them from the shkalim. And then again, is it only for sacrifices, or is it also for maintenance and any other activities that needed to be done in the temple? Okay, the Gemara continues and talks about the actual utensils that were in the temple, right? The shulchan, the table, the menorah, the candelabrum, the parochet, right? All of these are essential for the korbanot. And this is interesting in terms of, we know that a sacrifice needs to go on the altar, but how much of the temple is essential for that to happen? So one opinion is, no, we need all of these things to exist in order to bring sacrifices. And another opinion is they're not essential. We need certain things. We need the altar, and we need it to exist, but maybe other things are less essential. Again, not that they're not important, but how essential do they need to, are they? The Gemara on Daf 11 continues and talks about, again, this ramp, and says that each Kohen Gadol, every high priest, would break down the old ramp and then build up his own ramp. And this seems to be remarkable, right? Why does the high priest need to break it down? So the Gemara says, "Whoa! Is the Kohen Gadol, is the high priest so arrogant that he feels he needs to build his own ramp?" Another opinion is that it's showing honor, right? I want to dedicate, and interestingly, one opinion is that the high priest would use his own funds to build this ramp, and that he felt that this was a way to show honor to this mitzvah, right? And felt that he needed to do it on his own. So it's interesting to think about how they spent their money in those days, and we'll talk more about that a little bit later. Then the Gemara goes back to this idea about doing business, right? Can the temple treasurer take whatever's left over and use that to make money, right? We have something left over. Can we do that? And that's really a machloket, if they're allowed to. The same disagreement is also there when discussing the money of orphans, right? This is money that we want to, again, protect the orphans, right? Let's say somebody is the guardian, right? Can I now invest their money in the stock market? Maybe they'll make a lot of money. On the other hand, maybe they'll lose it. And we want to be very careful with their money. So too with the money in the temple. From here, the Gemara talks about other funds that were in the temple. So we have two other funds that were around. One is called Motar Peirot. And the Gemara explains that on 11 as the profits from sanctified items. Again, the idea is that when prices fluctuated, there seemed to have been profits that the temple made. So that's called motar. The word motar means like leftover. Peirot are fruit, but here it means objects. The other is motar nisachim. This is the leftover money when the market value changes of again, nesachim. Nesachim are the wine or the oil or the flour. So it could be that it's money. The other opinion is that, as you can see here, it's the actual leftover. You can see here that they would keep the quantities of flour when they measured it, but they didn't need all of that. So actually, like if you take a knife and kind of push off what was heaped over, that would be called motar nesachim. That's the leftovers. And again, that has value. So the question is what we can do with it. Can you sell it? Can you make money off of it? Again, you being the temple, not any personal gain. Again, the Gemara says that anything that was put into a sanctified vessel of the temple, that would be sanctified, and then you can't just sell it to whoever you want. The next Mishnah on 11 talks about, since we're talking about leftovers, what about the leftover ktoret, the incense that was burnt daily? The Mishnah, if those of you who are familiar, we say every Friday night a prayer called Pitom HaKtoret. And we also say it on Shabbat during the day. And Sfaradim actually say it every day, I think. But the idea is it describes hello everyone. Thank you so much for your patience and understanding. Thank you. There was some technical difficulties here, but let's resume. And I'll try to talk quickly and make up for lost time. And I'm so happy that the pictures are still here. Okay, we are on Daf 11. We were talking about leftover ktoret, the incense, and the Gemara says that you're not allowed to do anything else with the incense, and we'll see in a few minutes the family that created the incense. But they would take this the incense and use it actually for the next year, though you weren't allowed to do it. They figured out a way to basically sell it and buy it back with the new year's shekel. And therefore, they were able to reuse it with the money from the shekel that was collected from that year. So with that, we will finish. Hold on one second. Okay, we're moving on to Daf 12. We have a new Mishnah on Daf 12 that talks about when we dedicate things to the temple. We've discussed machatzita shekel. Everybody gives one coin, the same amount. But let's say you want to donate something to the temple. There were two ways to do that. You could take an animal, and donate it to the temple as a sacrifice, or you could donate anything you had in your house, and that went to Bedek Habayit. We've mentioned this before. This was a fund in the temple that was used for communal things and not for sacrifices. So let's say you dedicated all your possessions. So now there's a machloket. What happens, right? Someone takes their estate and they say, I dedicate everything I own. Do we assume that it's all going to Bedek Habayit, meaning we're going to sell your entire estate, and then we'll use that money for upkeep or for whatever we need in the temple? Or let's say you were a shepherd or a cowboy. Did you mean to dedicate the animals that you had to as sacrifices, and everything else, the chairs, the table, those things were going to be sold, and then you can use that money again for any expenditures that the temple had. So again, the Mishnah talks about any animals. If they were male, they go to an Ola. If they were females, they become Shlamim. Again, are those animals sanctified themselves? Do you sell them and buy new animals? Again, where does the sanctity go, and how much of it goes directly to the altar, and how much of it is, did you mean to give money or dedicate money to the temple? Let's say you had wine or oil in your cellar. Again, are those directly for the altar, or do we sell them and use the money for something else? The Gemara continues on Daf 12. And again, as we mentioned about the Ketoret, that is something that could not be used for private use. It could only be for the temple use. The Gemara continues again, as I mentioned, what happens if you sanctify your flock, right? So then I know that that is all going, right? If you say, I sanctify everything that's in the pasture, right? So then we know that you meant for these animals to be sacrifices. And that seems to be pretty clear. The question is, what if there are blemished animals, which we know cannot go cannot be sacrifices? Can we redeem them? And then what does the money go to, right? Does the money go, again, to the temple funds? Or maybe they are personal money, chulin, right? They are not sanctified. And there is a machloket about what happens with the money from the profits of these blemished animals. And here the Gemara kind of digresses to the concept of tmura. We have mentioned this before, especially in Masechet Psachim, when we were talking about different sacrifices. Tmura, just to remind us, is when there is an animal that you have sanctified for a certain sacrifice, and then you decide for whatever reason you want to bring another animal instead of this animal. So you say, you know what, instead of this animal, I want this nicer animal. You are
again, not allowed to do it or do it, but basically it works. The new animal is now sanctified, but the old animal did not lose its sanctity. And that is only, this only works if both animals are worthy to go on the altar. So there is that disagreement, that discussion at the bottom of Daf 12. On Daf 13, we continue about what if your animals are impure? What if they are tameh or disqualified? So then you can redeem those animals, and the money again goes back to Bedek HaBayit. We give it as money and not for the altar. Okay, the Mishnah on 13 talks about since we're talking about the funds and the treasury in the temple, it says that every 30 days they would set the prices of the supplies for the temple. And it didn't matter if the market value fluctuated, the temple always came out on top, as we would say, right? The profits always went to the temple. They always got the best deal. And therefore, the temple treasury never loses money. There's a discussion about how the money was given to the sellers or the suppliers of different things that were bought and when it became their money. And with that, we finish the fourth chapter in Masechet Shkalim. The fifth chapter speaks about various... Oh, are my pictures not here anymore? Oh, that's so sad. Okay. I did have lots of pictures, but maybe I'll try to email them to you because I don't have them on my
phone. Oh, try it now. I was presenter, so it should work now.
Oh, yeah?
Try again.
Oh, hold on. Let's see. Oh, I hope. Oh, yay. Okay, thank you. Okay, pictures are still here. These, again, Daf HaChaim came through for us, and he basically illustrated all of the 15 people that were mentioned, the jobs that people had in the temple. So I brought you some pictures just to see. And the Gemara is going to say, who are these people? It could be that these are what you would say the all-star team of these jobs. These were the best in all the generations of the temple. Or it could be that these were people from one specific generation. But here are the jobs. The first job is the person, Yochanan ben Pinchas. He's in charge of the chotamot. These are vouchers. We're going to talk about them in the Gemara in a minute. Achia was in charge of the nisachim. Again, the wine, the oil, and the flour. We're going to see that these two men work together. The vouchers were to pay for these libations that were put on the altar. Matia ben Shmuel was in charge of the lottery, of deciding who did which job every day, because every day they changed the jobs. Then we have Ptachia, who was in charge of the birds. As some of you know, there were sacrifices of turtle dove, of doves and Bnei Yonah. And anyway, these are the bird sacrifices. So you didn't bring your own birds. You actually, again, bought a voucher and the birds were sacrificed. Number five is Ben Achia Al Chole Me'ayim. He was in charge. He was, I guess, the temple doctor. He was in charge whenever they were sick. And the Gemara explains why they were sick so often. Number six is Nechunia, who was the Chofer Shichim. He was in charge of digging wells for water. Sarah, we're going to talk about the 70 languages in a minute. I'll explain each one of these things. Number seven is Gvini. He was the announcer. He was the one who said, it's the morning, it's time to start the avodah, the work in the temple. Number eight is Ben Gever. He was in charge of locking the gates and opening, right, unlocking and locking the gates.
Number 9 is Ben Bibi, who was in charge of the wicks. He was in charge of the wicks for the candelabrum, the menorah. Ben Arza was in charge of the tzaltzal, which here he writes musical instruments, but the Gemara says specifically the cymbals. Again, I'm going to say what each one of these are in a minute. 11 is Hugras ben Levi, who was the conductor. He was the choir leader. Again, singing in the temple is a very serious business. Number 12 is Ben Garmu, who is in charge of the Lechem HaPanim. And just those of you who have never seen this picture, this is the shape that they say is the shape of the showbread. It was a very special shape, and only one family had the tradition to make this bread, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Beit Avtinus, it was the family that was in charge of making the incense. Again, a secret family recipe. 14 was Elazar, who is in charge of the parochet, all of the curtains in the temple. And the last one is Pinchas, who was the malbish. He was the dresser. He would dress all of the kohanim, the kohen gadol specifically. Okay, and now the Gemara continues and explains what all of these things are. Again, as I mentioned, first, they discuss if these are all like the best or just all from the same generation. There's a discussion here about Rabbi Akiva and how he established the Mishnah, which we know he did not, meaning the editor of the Mishnah is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. But the Gemara explains that Rabbi Akiva, first of all, we know, and I think, again, very appropriately, Rabbi Akiva's 24,000 students died in this period of Sfirat HaOmer. It's one of the reasons that we observe certain customs of mourning in this time period because of the students of Rabbi Akiva who died. And the Gemara basically explains that because he had to start again, a lot of the Torah that we have is because of Rabbi Akiva. Another explanation is that Rabbi Akiva organized things. For those of you who are like me, who like lists, right, Rabbi Akiva was the one who organized. There are 5 grains that are chayav for challah. There are 10 of these. There are 36 of these. Right, we know there are 39 milachot for Shabbat. Right, lists of things that help us organize a lot of information. So that's Rabbi Akiva. Here I just have to, I know we're a little bit in a rush, but Ezra HaSofer, we talk about Ezra the Sofer and how he again established the tradition. And then we have a great story about the donkey of Pinchas, who wouldn't eat from non-Jews. And I think it's just a very fascinating story that, you know, they were so observant that the donkey of Pinchas wouldn't eat non-kosher food. He wouldn't eat food that wasn't tithed. Is very fascinating, interesting story, which you could think about. Okay, Sarah asked, why do we need someone who understands or speaks 70 languages? So the Gemara explains that the Sanhedrin, the great council, needed at least 2 people to speak 70 languages. And if not, right, a wise Sanhedrin is 4 people who spoke 70 languages. Why? Because they would be able to understand all of, if anybody came from all over the world to bring testimony, they wanted to make sure that they understood the testimony firsthand and not through a translator. And here the Gemara says that Ptachia is really Mordechai. For those of you familiar with the story of Purim, right? Mordechai is very smart, especially in the Megillah. We say that he understands many languages. Here the Gemara says on 13 that Ptachia here in our Mishnah is actually the Mordechai that we know from Megillat Esther, and how it was very important for Ptachia to understand what people were saying, especially in his job when he interacted with a lot of people. The bottom of 13, the doctor who is in charge of the Kohanim, that they got sick. Why were they getting sick? The Gemara says, well, because they had a lot of stomach issues, because they walked barefoot, they ate a lot of meat, And they drank water. And interestingly, the Gemara focuses on the fact that they drank water. That's what made them sick. But the doctor knew exactly what wine for them, that what they should drink in order for them to feel better. Da 14, Nechunya dug wells. There's a very important job of knowing where water is. The Gemara talks about people who would dig water, who knew where the wells are. And then there's like a story of this tzaddik who dug wells, but then his daughter drowned. And they said, how could it be? He's the one who knew what the water was, and now he's being punished by water. And then the Gemara is like, oh, maybe you're right. Maybe his daughter was actually saved. So that's interesting if the daughter was saved or not. The caller of the Kohanim, what does it mean that he was the caller? Again, he was the one who said that everyone should take their positions. It's time to start the work. His voice carried very far. He had, this very loud, booming voice. Ben Gever is the one who announced the morning. Gever is, there's a machloket if that's a person or a rooster. But right when the roosters crow, that's when they knew it was time for the morning. Interestingly, they ask, why is the person in charge of wicks mentioned here? It doesn't seem like a very important job. So he says, right, like people should, it says that he was merited to be counted with the great people of the generation, right? And the point here is, right, the mission is trying to give us a message, right, that if you take up communal responsibilities, every position is important. It doesn't matter if you're the one in charge of the air conditioning or the lights in the shul. Each job is important, and we celebrate you for giving back to the community. What about, as I mentioned, the head of the choir had a beautiful voice. Beit Garmu, as I mentioned, they were a family that knew how to make the lechem hapanim, and the Gemara is a little bit critical of them because it seems that they extorted the temple and said that, like, if you fire us, no one's going to know how to make the bread, and then they had to rehire them at a higher price. The same thing with Beit Avtinus. They knew how to make the ktoret, and it seems that they extorted the temple and said, you need to pay us a certain amount, otherwise we're not coming back. Though, interestingly enough, there's another story that said that Beit Avtinus really guarded their secret because they didn't want it to get into the wrong hands. We know that the incense, the ktoret, was a very important part of the temple service, and they didn't want anybody knowing their secret, lest they use that secret for bad things. Again, the person in charge of the parochet was the person in charge of the weavers, as we mentioned before. And the Gemara ends off by saying that the person in charge of dressing the Kohen Gadol was someone who made a lot of money. And it seems that people hired him because it was a really, it was a very prominent position. And he went out and made a lot of money dressing other people as well. The Mishnah now continues on different positions of influence in the temple, and it said that if you had a position of influence, you needed to work in pairs. There needed to be checks and balances in the temple, specifically in the treasury. And here is just a picture. I'm not going to go through it, but you can read how basically when the treasurer, that's the gizbar, wanted to kind of close off the accounts, he would sign it off and hand it over to another person who would sign it off to another person. And you can see here how it went through many people, including the Kohen Gadol and the high priest and the king. And everybody sealed the money. I guess it's their way of like putting it in a safe. And then if you needed to take out money, you needed to go back through every person to make sure that every person identified their seal. So it's just interesting to see how the treasury worked in the temple and how careful they were to make sure that things were protected and that nobody, on one hand, nobody stole, and on the other hand, as we mentioned last week, that there's no suspicion of impropriety. From here, we get into really great stories, I thought, of Moshe and the tablets. We're going to talk about that Now, so it says that Moshe, since we're talking about people being wealthy, it says Moshe became wealthy from the carvings of the Luchot. And the Gemara here says that the tablets that Moshe, right, inscribed, at least the second ones, were we always envision rock. So here the Gemara says that they were actually made out of sapphire. So can you imagine that every time he chiseled out a word, all those carvings went on the floor, and Moshe was able to take those carvings and ended up being a very wealthy man. And from here it says that Moshe, that people gazed at Moshe either in a negative way, they thought he misappropriated temple funds, or they were very positive and said, wow, we wish we can merit such wealth like Moshe. From here, we have a Mishnah that talks about, as I mentioned before, the those chotamot, those vouchers. So let's see how that worked. There were vouchers that were proof of payment, right? So you went to the temple. Let's say you needed to bring a sacrifice of birds or of the libations. You paid money. You got these tickets. Then you went to the next person who's in charge of those sacrifices. You gave in your tickets, and then they knew that Tamara needs this sacrifice. At the end of the day, the Mishnah describes that the two people would get together and they would compare, do we have the same amount of money for vouchers? And if there was a discrepancy, they needed to make up for that discrepancy. And here the Mishnah talks about there were four types of these vouchers. Each one had a different value for the different libations that was needed for each one of these sacrifices. Just as an aside, when we say the Musaf prayer, either on Shabbat or on a festival, in our prayer we say, these are the sacrifices that were brought, and these are the libations, the nesachim, that were brought with it. And that's exactly what we're talking about right here. You got these vouchers to pay for the libations, the nesachim, the wine and the oil that went along with every sacrifice. Next, Daf 15. The Mishnah talks about on 15, there are two special chambers in the temple. One was called, I call it the Chamber of Secrets. Really, it means the Chamber of Discretion, but I like secrets just for Harry Potter fans. So Chamber of Secrets and a chamber for the vessels. And what were these chambers? The Chamber of Secrets or Discretion was people who wanted to give charity. People would put money into that chamber, and people would take money out without knowing who gave the money. And as Maimonides explains, the Rambam explains, that the best way to give charity is by giving anonymously and by receiving anonymously, right? Nobody knows who's giving it and who's getting it. So the temple was a way, this chamber was a way to facilitate that. And the vessel was, if you wanted to donate a vessel, you could donate it to this chamber. And after 30 days, they would basically clear out the chamber, whatever vessel they could use, they used, and whatever they couldn't use, they would sell. And again, the money went to Bedek HaBayit, as we mentioned before, upkeep of the temple. And from here, there are some very interesting stories about giving charity. And I think that these are very important stories. Again, the idea of giving anonymously or at night, these are the ways to give charity. And I want to mention the pasuk that they mention here is Ashrei Maskil El Dal, meaning praise be the person who understands the poor person. What does that mean? That when you give charity, it's very important for you to think about who is the person I'm giving it to? What do they need? What is the best way that I can give this charity? Obviously, it should be with happiness, with a smile. It's more than that. And here there are a few stories about being very smart about how you give charity. And unfortunately, there's some very tragic stories on DAF 15 that talk about people who just want to give money without thinking about who is their audience, like who is the person who's getting it and what do they need. And unfortunately, two of the people in our stories and the Gemara actually died. The poor person dies because he didn't get what he needed. The rich person gave him one thing, but he really needed another. Or the other person, interestingly enough, is Nachum Ish Gamzu. He's a famous character in the Talmud. His name means Gamzu means also this, but he's really called that because he always said Gamzu Litova, this is also for good. And there are many stories about him in the Talmud about whenever things were rough for him, he said, this is for the best, this is for the best. Unfortunately, we actually have a very tragic story about someone asks him for money, and he's on the way to do something very positive, and he says, you know what, I'll give it to you on my way back. And unfortunately, on his way back, this poor person had already died. And Nachum Ish Gamzu looks at him at the corpse, unfortunately, and he curses himself. And he says, the eyes that didn't see the person should go blind, and the arms that didn't give charity should be cut off, and the legs should be cut off. And unfortunately, the Gemara says that all of these things happen, and he suffers a very tragic end. But interestingly, he is very thankful. He says, I need to suffer as atonement for my lack of sensitivity. Again, there are a lot of messages here. Interestingly, when I actually taught this daf yesterday to my group of women, and one of the members of my group said, this reminds her of right after the Holocaust, when people in here, in terms of like wanting to give but not knowing how, right, the soldier, there are a lot of stories, unfortunately, of American soldiers wanting to give lots of food, unfortunately, to the survivors, and their stomachs couldn't handle it. And unfortunately, many people died because they overate, right? They thought that they could just eat and eat and eat. Unfortunately, it just wasn't good for them. I just want to take a moment. This week is Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, Wednesday night and Thursday, where we remember the Holocaust and those who perished. And I think that I think there are many lessons to be learned. And I think one of them is this, right, to maybe in our way to be sensitive when giving charity. With that, I'm going to transition to other stories. There were stories about honoring blind people and how to honor them. And when we give honor to, again, those in need, there are beautiful consequences, meaning there's a story here of someone honoring a blind person and everybody says, oh, he must be very important. I need to give him charity. And he says, and I thought it's such a beautiful idea. He says, you saw a person who cannot see, right? So he says, I'm blessing you. I'm a person who is seen but cannot see. And my blessing to you is that God, who sees but is not seen, right? We don't see God, but he sees everything. He should bless you back. And there's a beautiful play on what we see and what we don't see, right? Who sees people and who doesn't see people? And I think that this is a beautiful lesson to all of us to see the people who are not always seen. And with that, we finish the fifth chapter. And just quickly, I want to finish, we're going to start the sixth chapter. The Daf 15 has a Mishnah about, as I mentioned, the 13 collection boxes. There are also 13 tables and places to bow. We're not going to talk about that. We'll talk about that next week. But the Gemara mentions that, as I mentioned before, these collection boxes were called shofarot because they looked like a shofar. They were bent. They were narrow on top and wide on the bottom because, again, we don't want anyone sticking their hands in and taking the money. From here, the Gemara has a fascinating discussion about the ark, about in the Mishnah, it talks about that there was one place where they collected the wood, and Rabban Gamliel had a tradition that he would bow down over there. And the question is why? Because he had a tradition that the ark, the Aron HaBrit, was buried in this chamber. And there's a story about a priest who was working in this place, and he saw that the floor was a little bit uneven. And when he wanted to tell somebody about it, he died. And they said, oh, it must be that that's where the ark is hidden. And from here, we have fascinating discussion. There's a machloket if the ark was taken into exile with the Jewish people. Those of you who have seen the picture of the Arc de Triomphe, or the Rappaport Monument, the Rappaport Memorial in Warsaw has a picture of, the Jewish people taking out the Ark. So one idea is that the Ark was taken to exile with the Jewish people. Another is it never left Jerusalem, and it stayed in its place, and it was buried. That's one very interesting discussion. Then the Gemara says, actually, there were two arks. There were two Arons because one idea is that there was one for the tablets that were whole, and there was one for the tablets that were broken. Those of you who are familiar with the in Shmot, in Exodus, God tells Moshe to build an ark for the tablets. But later on, God tells Bezalel to build an ark for the tabernacle, for the Mishkan. So the question is, are these the same ark? Is there only one? Or are there two? And here the Gemara has a beautiful difference of opinion as to what really happened. On the top of 16, the Gemara says that what else was in the ark? So we know the tablets. So again, if there's only one ark, you have the full tablets, you have the broken tablets. You also have a jar of the man that fell from heaven in the desert. You also have the oil that they anointed kings with, which we're going to talk about in a minute, the staff of Aaron that flowered. Again, it was miraculous. And the box that the Philistines sent back with the Aaron. All of this was hidden together, and King Yoshiahu was the one who hid it. And from here, there's a discussion about the Shemen HaMishcha, the oil that they used to anoint all the kings, we'll talk about in a minute, and everything in the temple. Apparently, it was made by Moshe in the desert, and it lasted forever, which is an interesting concept. And it had all these perfumes in it. The Gemara then talks about who gets anointed. So a king who's the first in line, right? So Shaul, Saul, got anointed. He's the first king. David gets anointed because he's the first in his line. And if there is a difference of, right, if there are contentions to the throne, then you anoint, even if they are like Shlomo, King Solomon is anointed because he has brothers who want the monarchy for themselves. Also, the high priest is anointed every generation, meaning even if it's his children take over, then he gets anointed. And the rest of this oil is left for Olam Haba. It is in the next world where it will then anoint, I guess, Moshiach and subsequent people. From here, there's a whole discussion about different kings that were anointed. I'm not going to go into all the details, but just interesting, the Gemara talks about being anointed from a horn, a keren. And as opposed to from a flask. And it says that if the king was anointed from a keren, a horn, it meant that his monarchy was going to last a long time, which is interesting because in our prayer of the Amidah, we talk about keren David, the horn of David. So it's interesting that horn symbolizes long-lasting longevity. So that actually is here from here in the in our Gemara. Sorry, I'm talking so fast, but I want to get everything in. Okay, let's just do a few more things about the Aron. Just brought you some pictures. What did the Aron look like? What were the measurements? There's a difference of opinion if the Amma was 5 or 6 hand breaths. That determined a difference of the dimensions of the Aron. And here you can see what was inside. Again, oh, 1 second. Again, depending on what the dimensions were, everyone agreed that the tablets were inside, again, broken and full, which is interesting. Was the Sefer Torah on the outside? That's this white one. Is it outside or inside the ark? So that is the discussion. And from here, just an interesting idea of how was the ark created? We know that it needed to be gold on the inside and the outside. The question is, was it 3 boxes, one inside the other, as you can see here on the right, or it was one box that was then covered in gold inside and out? And the last fascinating discussion on this daf is how were the tablets written on, right? We all take certain things for granted, which is the top right opinion, which is there were 2 tablets, right? We have Aseret HaDibrot, the 10 commandments, 1 through 5 on one tablet, and then 6 through 10 on the other tablet. That's, I think, at the top of every ark in every synagogue, or most synagogues that I've been to. That is only one opinion in our Gemara. And the Gemara continues and says, no, all 10 were written on each one, meaning so it's, you could see here, that's the top left, right? 1 through 10 on one tablet, 1 through 10 on the other. The other option is it was written on 2 sides, 10 on each side. And the other is that it was written, as you could see on the last one, 10 on each side, meaning, bottom right is front and back, 10 on front and back. And the other is 10 on every surface of the tablet. So it's just interesting, I think, that we take a lot of these ideas for granted that there's one opinion. Here you can see there are actually 4 different opinions on what the tablets looked like. Again, none of these people ever saw the tablets. So it's really about how you interpret the verses in the Torah. And I think it's just really beautiful to see. I'll just finish with one last thing, is that the Gemara here on the bottom of 16 talks about the fiery letters, right? That the luchot, the tablets, were written with white fire, and it was engraved with black fire. Just to give you that visualization, that's what a Torah scroll looks like, right? Think about the black letters on a white parchment, right? So the Gemara says, right, it's black fire that's engraved in a white fire, on a white fire. And it says that it was given with fire. And the last line of this daf talks about the pasuk, Eish dat lamo, right? That the tablets were given within fire. And I want to dedicate this last line to my niece, whose name is Odell. The name Odell comes from these 3 words, Eish dat lamo. Odell, meaning the first 3 letters of the pasuk, is right, the idea that God gave us these 10 commandments within fire, and there's fire consuming everything, and that should inspire us and enlighten us as we learn the Torah. So thank you very much, everyone. Sorry for the technical problems, but thank you for sticking with me. and wish everybody a really great week. And as you see, Shkalim has great stories. So stay tuned. Next week, we're going to finish Masechet Shkalim, if you can believe it. We're going to finish it together. And then I think I'll do, an introduction to Masechet Yoma. I really encourage everyone to continue. Masechet Yoma is a beautiful Masechet that really speaks about the services in the temple on Yom Kippur. It will change the way that you think about Yom Kippur, I think. Looking forward to learning with you next week, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Tamara.